Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. In the readings that we've been doing, there's a short quote or short statement of the Buddha's saying that all phenomena arise out of desire. And that, there's a certain conundrum there in the sense of having to learn how to recognize what is arising out of a wholesome desire or an unwholesome desire, what's actually beneficial, what's not beneficial, how do you tell? Can you tell? You know, it's easy to get confused by it all. You know, I think it's something that we have to be very alert and be willing to investigate closely, because sometimes it's really hard to tell. Remember, one of the first teachings of Ajahn Chah that I came across, I think it had been written down and was sort of passed around. And it was of a circumstance when somebody came to pay respects to Ajahn Chah and asked him what was the fundamental teaching of the Buddha. What was the teaching about? What was the essence of it? And Ajahn Chah picked up a, just like this, say something like this. I don't know what it was, but it was like a stick like this, and say it was, you know, is this a big stick or a little stick? And of course, the person was confused and uncertain what Ajahn Chah was talking about or asking for, and he expressed his confusion. And Ajahn Chah sort of said, well, you know, if you wanted to pick your teeth, then you'd say, you know, this is a really big stick. But if you wanted to build a house, you'd say, well, it's just a really small stick, and it's just a small piece of wood. So it would depend on what you wanted, what the desire was. And desire was what was generating, dictating, determining how we viewed things and how we perceived and the values that we put on things. And then Ajahn Chah saying that's really the essence of the Buddha's teachings is understanding desire. Being able to see clearly the nature of desire. And again, that's where you think, it could be good or bad, or it could be neutral. But yeah, there's this force of desire pushing everything. And oftentimes we don't recognize it, understand it, don't realize that we're even in the grip of desire, so that we're just sort of unwitting accomplices to our various desires, and we'll support them, look at, feed them, care for them, as we desire. So that being able to really recognize, and then say that, even things that are, when you you start, you know, parsing out the things that the Buddha calls defilement or the kilesa, greed, hatred, delusion. And it isn't as if those are really completely separate categories. They're on a certain level, they're kind of manifestations of different kinds of desire. It's like when they're, greed is fairly straightforward. But then, you know, much of aversion, ill will is hatred, is generated because somebody thwarts what you desire, what you want, what you prefer. And it has a root as well, that root in being and desire. Or, you know, even kind of delusion, just the way that desire manifests in ways of creating confusion or having agendas that keep us clouded. It works in many ways. Or, you know, even when you think of the three kinds of desire that the Buddha points to as the cause of suffering, Kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha, they have different ways of expressing themselves and have a different effect on the mind. So that we need to be willing to recognize how it works, how it manifests. But then also there's that reflection that, you know, does that mean that all desire is kind of, you know, evil, wicked, mean and nasty sort of thing? Because, you know, we need to generate desire in order to, I mean, that's actually, I would say, one of the, you say, in the formula or in the refrain that points to right effort. In order to arouse right effort, we need to generate desire, bringing up desire in order to generate effort. Or there's a sutta where Ananda, it's in the Anguttara Nikaya somewhere, where Ananda points to desire being, say, a root of suffering, a root of birth, root of existence. But one hears that about somebody who is practiced, somebody who is accomplished in their practice, who has liberated their heart, who's freed their mind from suffering. And one conceives the desire, when will I be like that person? and that's a really wholesome desire. When will I be able to free my heart from greed, hatred, and delusion? When will I be able to free my heart from suffering? And through that generation of desire, one then overcomes desire. You know, we love to try to see things in black and white, yes and no, absolutely good, absolutely bad, absolutely right, absolutely wrong, and we get ourselves in trouble. We don't. By doing that, we actually just skim the surface of experience. We're not really able to penetrate and understand. So that this, and particularly around this aspect of desire that the Buddha says is all things are rooted in desire. We have to be willing to investigate and understand and learn how to both to be able to be on our guard as well as to be able to utilize and encourage ourselves. You know, and when we reflect on desires or to seeing. I mean, certainly seeing the drawback and the difficulty that arises from desire. It's like the Ajahn Chah gives this, remember him telling this story of the Supreme Patriarch in the Sangharaja from the past, who had been invited to go to China. And when he went to China, then they went as a delegation, and of course he's the head of the delegation, and they the Chinese offered this very ancient, priceless tea cup, and of course he was very touched, moved by this, appreciative. But then, of course, there's the desire comes along, and then he's worried about this teacup, and having to, whenever he packed it really well, and to get it back to Thailand, and you know, when anybody would get near his bag, I said, "Be careful of that teacup," you know. There's bags didn't show up quite on time. So I wonder what happened to that teacup. And so he's that desire's there, and he finally gets it back and displays it in a really prominent place. And anybody had come and said, "Well, we got this teacup it's really ancient. It's really priceless. It's from China. It's the real deal." And desire is there, the days and nights relentlessly pass. And one day, one of his attendant monk is sort of diligently cleaning up, and he knocks the teacup over, and smashes on the ground. The Supreme Patriarch looks over. "Oh, free from suffering around that, fine." he could recognize, but there's that compulsion, the desire is there. And there's, on a certain level, there's that care and appreciation and gratitude. It's all mixed up together. It isn't it wasn't careless or sloppy or it wasn't disregarding, but when it finally did break, it was what a relief. Even the things that we love and desire and cherish, they can be a burden to us because of the desire that's there. So that just being able to recognize and investigate that, see what those different forces are. See what desire is generating, because it can be generating like, dislike, and generating a sense of self around things, that bhavatanha, that sense of, especially as an example, "Wow, I'm such an important person because they gave me this teacup." But what's that say when how important, if your teacup breaks, how important are you? you build your image and your world around things, and they're generated out of desire, and what happens when it changes? These are sources of suffering. So that being able to understand, investigate, and then seeing the danger in that, and saying, "Okay, I'm not gonna be anything. I'm not gonna want anything. I'm not gonna have anything." Is that actually the way out of suffering? Because so often it's vibhava tanha. It's another form of desire. I don't want, shouldn't be, can't have, pushing away, rejecting another form of desire. You see, this, the web of desire that we're caught in, it keeps pulling us down. So this is where this learning how to understand it, to see it, to reflect on it, to see, understand the nuances, being willing to attend to that, to recognize the ways that desire works, and then of course it, you know, throws up these screens of delusion around things, and we get caught, we get hooked. Ajahn Chah was sort of thinking of that, getting caught, getting hooked. Is, you know, Ajahn Chah giving the image of, you know, as beings and human beings, we're not much better than fish that see a bit of bait on a hook and they grab onto the bait and see it. And then he says, well, actually, say we're worse than the fish. The fish only get the hook caught in their mouth. And he said, we're more like frogs. The frogs just swallow it right down to their stomach. Okay. So that we get caught. And being able to see that. But we tend to be so used to. Yeah, we tend to be so used to, yeah, the world of desire that we kind of swim in, and that we're comfortable with. Our security is in the things, the ways that we can gratify desire, or get the things that we want, that we prefer, that make us comfortable, make us feel secure. Say when we're not able to have those in the way, shape, or form that we prefer, then we feel uncomfortable. We feel ill at ease. We have dis-ease. We have suffering. And it's like, you know, in the same way that we swim in the kind of the waters of desire, or the ocean of desire. In the same way that you take a fish out of water and it just flops around, and put it on the land, and it's just, they're not happy campers. They need to be put back into the water. And the same, you know, similarly, let's say as human beings, ordinary unenlightened human beings, we swim in the waters of desire, and we're not really comfortable if we're not there. And that's why much of the Buddhist practice, spiritual practice, monastic practice, the way that we live and the way that we train, we have to be willing to test that and see what are the, we have to challenge those assumptions that we have, challenge that tendency to just swim in the waters of desire all the time. Yeah. Do we always have to be fish, or can we be turtle sometimes? You can go in the water sometimes and get out on the land sometimes. Ability to adapt to recognize what's useful, what's beneficial, what's appropriate at different times. Yeah, and the training can be. It's actually designed to challenge our desires, to go against the stream of desire. But it's also, one has to learn how to hold the training properly and recognize what's essential, what's necessary, what's the purpose of it. think of a, there's a story in the Dhammapada commentary of a Anupapa. He's a banker's son, and he was got faith in one of the monks who came alms round and to their house, and then asked him what he could do. So then the monk encouraged him to, because he's a banker's son, wealthy, comfortable, but dissatisfied, discontent. So asked him what he, so then asked the monk what he could do. So the monk encouraged him to be generous, make offerings, be open-handed with things, be willing to share, don't be selfish. So that he picked that up as a practice, worked with it, trained with it, felt a bit better, but just, still dissatisfied, asking, okay, went back to the monk, what can I, what else can I do? He said, well, you can, keep the precepts, take refuges. So this goes on, and that's one of the, Anupaba means basically one who follows a gradual path, gradual training. So he laid the foundation of different practices and still discontent. And I said, so, well, what can I do? He said, well, should ordain, leave the worldly life. Take on a spiritual practice, live in the monastery. So, great, I'll go for it. That really made him discontent and suffer. And he was really discouraged and really, really fed up. And he's gonna leave. Now, I didn't suffer this much as a layperson. I'll go back and I'll live the life of in the world. So then, of course, the monks knew what was going on, told the Buddha, and the Buddha asked him, "Are you discontent?" He said, "Oh yeah, I'm discontent. I'm suffering. What's the problem?" He said, "Well, it's." And my preceptor is a Vinaya master, and he tells me, I can't do this, and I can't do that, and this, and there's this rule, and there's that training rule, and I said, I feel like the idiom they use, I can't even stretch my hands out. And he said, and then my teacher is a Dhamma master. And he gives me this list and that list to memorize and learn all these teachings, and I just feel cramped and then there's just too much to learn, too much to do, too much to train with. It's impossible. And the Buddha said, "Well, can you do just one thing?" He said, "Well, if it was only just one thing, I could do one thing." I said, what's that? And the Buddha said, well, if you just guard your mind, that's enough. So that was the Buddha's instruction. Just to guard the mind, to be able to understand the mind, to be, because we tend to get, trapped in the externals and the details and the myriad manifestations of phenomena, and then all the desire that kind of generates around it, whether it's sort of a positive, negative, liking, disliking, comfortable, uncomfortable, it creates layers of complication. So just learning how to guard the mind, learning how to look after the mind, learning how to watch the mind, learning how to see the mind. Just this one thing. And, that's a... it's easy to say, it's not so easy to do. But it's important to remind ourselves that's the essence of it. That's the foundation of the practice, and to be able to to recognize the different ways that desire is kicking out or kicking up, and how it can be utilized, how it needs to be channeled, how it needs to be applied. Because it's like we sit down in meditation and I want to make my mind peaceful. But then there's this to do and there's that to do, and I've got to get these four foundations of mindfulness, and then I have to be ardent, alert. It's all the things that we've been talking about. Ardent, alert, mindful, turning away from the greed and distress towards the world. And then it's to the body and the mind. So all of a sudden it's really complicated. And being able to just, how do I settle? How do I generate a sense of interest and motivation? Because sometimes when we're meditating and practicing, it's important to seed the mind with a certain a thought or a desire. You can call it a desire. It's just sort of just picking up a kind of a theme that the mind says, like, okay, careful or caring or content. Okay, these are ways to seed the mind so that it's moving in a certain direction, encouraging and guiding the mind so that it's settling or it's clearing or it's releasing or it's say energized, depending what one needs. And so that there is a certain desire there, but then it's also being held skillfully. It's being held in a way that is, encouraging, or is sometimes, guarding the mind, being careful, being circumspect, just reminding the mind what it needs. As we do that, then we can develop the kind of the specifics of the meditation in a skillful way, and not get too entangled or tight about it, or because that's one of the things. Like one can sometimes, in terms of like, we can get tight or wound up or uncomfortable if we feel we need to to challenge desire, go against the stream of desire, but then we get all wound up about it, and where there's a sense of yes, we do need to challenge that desire, but it's also seeing what can we learn, what are we learning from it, how are we understanding it, how are we holding it? And are we becoming peaceful? Are we becoming happy? Are we becoming clear? Because those are the qualities that are essential. So that this sense of looking after the practice, learning how to guard the mind, to look after the mind. In the Dhammapada verse that story comes from, the Buddha points to the mind, being kind of immaterial and fine, or like refined, and because of that, it needs to be looked after. because it can be pulled in so many directions. So learning how to guard it, learning how to look after it. It's also learning how to motivate the mind, because sometimes we're so used to external measures of, I don't know, getting ahead, accomplishing something, success, in air quotes, unconsciously we oftentimes apply that same standard to that training of the mind. And then, of course, it doesn't apply, because you can't take an extrinsic standard for what is actually progress on the path or accomplishment in our spiritual practice. And then we need to tune into an intrinsic quality of moving forward or progress, success in practice, and the internal qualities. And that is, those are sometimes more difficult to discern. But that's why it's important, again, to be reflecting and paying attention, being willing to tease things apart and see more clearly, well, what actually is really beneficial. Because you think even it's just something like the quality of contentment. I mean, that's an internal quality, an intrinsic experience of the relinquishing of desire. But what's it actually mean to be content? And as opposed to then that, you know, something getting what we want, getting winning the prize, getting the praise, getting the diploma. And the experience of contentment is more difficult to define. So that we have to pay attention to what it feels like, what the experience is, so that we can be nurturing it and looking after it. Also, just we're so used to, that sense of getting, gaining, accomplishing, accumulating, that to put something down, to relinquish, to release, sometimes not so noticeable. So that you have to make that, you have to experiment with that, you have to work with that. So what's it feel like to put down a mood of attachment, of aversion or irritation? And what's it feel like to put it down? Yes, especially with something like, say, irritation or aversion. It feels like suffering to put it down, because it felt so good already to be just, that justification of irritation, the sense of being right and somebody else being wrong. There's a certain gratification in that, and to put it down is uncomfortable. And of course, it's perpetuating suffering, but it's hard to put it down. You know, it feels so good to scratch a sore on your arm, but it just keeps spreading the sore. So there is a sense of being able to see the okay, well, what's it feel like? How to put it down, and how to recognize this? Okay, that challenging of desire, that going against the stream of desire, is something there is a difficulty there, but then it's also learning how to work with that so that there's a sense of ease and clarity it arises from that. Understanding the nature of desire, understanding the the kind of little, the hooks and tendrils that desire sort of puts in and complicates things. So that as we practice and develop, and both in terms of in our day-to-day life as well as in our meditation, just that reflecting on the nature of desire, understanding how it works, and then seeing how that relinquishing and cessation of desire is something that's where there's a sense of peace. And this, this is peaceful. This is sublime. This is the cessation of suffering. And this is something that is a refrain in the suttas, where there's a sense of, oh wow, yeah, like this is really sublime. This is peaceful. This is the cessation of suffering. This is really, really desirable. I'll offer that for reflection this evening.